Agricultural and Natural Resources for April 22nd, 2003. It's great to have you all here today. We have a, I think, an agenda that we're actually going to complete all the way through for a change. First up, we have a briefing by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a Foreign Ag Service from Robert C., and John Schapinski from Oregon Department of Agriculture. Gentlemen, if you would come forward. Folks, we're going to have an informational hearing on the Farm Bill and how it affects Oregon agriculture. But before we do that, let me again state for the record, as I do at the beginning of every meeting, that if you are a government official or a lobbyist and you have signed the sign-up sheet to testify on legislation, you are acknowledging that you are aware of the two Oregon revised statutes that govern your testimony as having to be truthful and accurate. If you're a member of the public at large, I'm not sure anybody is here, might be. If you're a member of the public at large, this doesn't apply to you, but on the other hand, we still want your testimony to be accurate and truthful anyway. So having said that, we welcome all of you once again, and we are going to open up an informational hearing. And with us today, journeying all the way from Washington, D.C., is Robert C. Robert, welcome. Thanks for coming out. For the record, state your name.
Okay. For the record, my name is Robert C. I'm with the Foreign Agricultural Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And thank you for inviting me. And I guess the last time we met, we were in Dallas. And I was trying to get back to Washington, D.C., and couldn't get back for 2 or 3 days because of the snow. So the weather's a lot different now, similar to here today. What I thought I would do is, in terms of, give you just a quick synopsis of the presentation, is to give you a snapshot of the Farm Bill and then focus on the international trade portion of the Farm Bill,
okay,
which covers the Foreign Agricultural Service, and then go through some of the details in terms of the benefits of agricultural exports to the U.S. economy or U.S. agriculture. So with that, I'll start. And okay, the first thing is the Farm Bill, which is the Farm Security and Rural Investment Act of 2002. It is a comprehensive bill that covers all aspects of U.S. Society, actually. And to give you an idea, what I have put up here are the 10 titles of the Farm Bill. And you can quickly see it covers everything from commodity programs, conservation, agricultural trade, farm credit, rural development. From food stamps to food aid, that Farm Bill covers all those issues. If you actually saw the legislation, it's about this thick, kind of hard to read. So probably within the Department of Agriculture, there's probably no one person who could tell you about every aspect of the Farm Bill. So what I'm going to focus on is the area of my expertise, agricultural trade and aid. But before I get into that, I can give you a quick summary of the overall Farm Bill. And some of the what is in the Farm Bill is, as a summary, it continues direct decoupled payments. And those are the program payments, which are disconnected from actual production, is what that means. The Farm Bill, what is new about the Farm Bill, it does create a system of counter-cyclical payments, which is new. It revises the loan rates for agriculture. It expands conservation funding and programs. It contains an energy title, which was not there before, and substantial more research funds are invested into animal and plant disease protection, food safety, and rural development. For those of you who are interested in more of the details of the Farm Bill, you can actually find all of this information on the USDA website. And it goes title by title on the website. If you look on the international part of the Farm Bill, agricultural trade and aid, basically you will see the guiding principles for how the Foreign Agricultural Service itself functions. The Market Access Program is our principal program, which is the change in that program. It used to be funded at $90 million a year. It is being raised to $200 million by 2006. The way to think about the Market Access Program, it is our principal program for promotion of products overseas where U.S. companies participate in that program and can get some of their costs covered, returned. There is the Export Enhancement Program, which is an older program, which was renewed in the Farm Bill. And the funding level for that is $478 million, the maximum level which was extended. There's the Dairy Export Incentive Program, which is the Export Enhancement Program and the Dairy Export Incentive Program are both bonus payment programs. They are principally set up in response to unfair trading practices of other countries, and we principally look at the European Union for that as the justification for those two programs. The Foreign Market Development Cooperative Program, or FMD, is a program in the $30 million area which funds what we call FAS cooperators or commodity groups that engage in export promotion activities. The Export Credit Guarantee Program under the Farm Bill, the minimum funding of that is $5.5 billion. That is a program which covers a series of what, in effect, is export transaction insurance. In other words, if you are an exporter and you have bank financing, you can insure that against a loss that your buyer doesn't pay, and your bank is insured against that. The way to think of it is it's very similar to home mortgage insurance. The purpose of that program is to encourage U.S. banks to lend to exporters, particularly if they're trading in countries where the foreign buyer or the foreign currency or the foreign bank might be a little bit more risky than the U.S. bank might otherwise feel comfortable with. Another aspect of the programs under the Farm Bill are the Supplier Credit Guarantee Program. It's a similar transaction insurance program, only this one, it's a short-term program. And one of the changes that Congress made was to extend the terms from 180 days to 360 days. The significance of that program is that unlike the other two programs I mentioned, which use letters of credit, this uses promissory notes. And it's particularly for small businesses, it actually is probably more useful in today's business environment. Congress authorized approximately about $1 billion of direct credits or credit guarantees for FAS to use to promote agricultural exports in emerging markets. And so that sets a ceiling for us, or a floor, depending upon your interpretation. We also administer the Emerging Markets Program, which for developing countries, it's a program that we look into sort of grant programs working with states, partially, where it's funded up to $10 million. What is new in the Farm Bill is the Technical Assistance for Specialty Crops. Specialty crops are non-program commodities. The easy way to think of that is basically it's fruits, vegetables, and forest products. And that program is a grant program that is set up to address the sanitary, phytosanitary barriers for specialty crops. And it's funded to $2 million a year. This is a new program. And states and commodity groups and other entities can come in and apply to that program. And basically what they're trying to do is identify a trade barrier, and they can come in and identify that and study it and come up with either proof that it is a trade barrier or come up with some possible solutions to that. There's a biotechnology and agricultural trade program. As you read in the papers all the time, a lot of these issues that come up and that you see around the world are biotechnology or GMO issues, or food safety, or disease issues that I guess recently in Japan there was the outbreak of mad cow there. Well, it doesn't apply to us directly, but if we had to do a response, that program in the Farm Bill allows us, it funds a sort of a quick response or SWAT team response, I guess you could call it that, to respond to any of these issues that are not anticipated. Lastly, that's new is a exporter assistance initiative, and essentially what that is it authorizes USDA to create a website that would contain all the information on the regulations, the legal requirements, and other federal laws affecting exports. And you might ask, you know, why hasn't that already been done? Well, one of the aspects of USDA is that there are 25 different agencies at USDA, of which maybe at least 6 to 8 have some component of international trade, and each agency in turn has its own website. and they're not necessarily connected. So this is an attempt on, from a customer perspective, to put it all in one spot. And so this is part of the initiative going on in the department, and that's part of the Farm Bill. The other part of Title III is the aid side or food aid part that FAS is responsible for. And we call it the PL 480 program because that's the original law passed in the 1950s creating the U.S. food aid programs. Those were renewed through 2007 under the Farm Bill. And for those of you who are not familiar with the food aid programs, the food aid actually, the way it's implemented is some of it is direct food aid, shipment of products overseas. Some of the food aid programs operate by where the food is shipped overseas and sold on, under concessional credit terms or basically almost 0% interest to a country. And the authorization under the Farm Bill has raised the minimum tonnage. In this case, they focus on tonnage, not dollars. Eligible for the Food for Peace program was raised to 2.5 million tons. And one change, this program allows now sales in dollars. Prior to that time, the sale of product in that country that received the aid was in the local currency. This now allows some of the sales to be in dollars.
Robert, what's the significance of that particular change, allowing the sales to be in dollars?
What has happened in the past is when you sell a product in the local currency, you oftentimes, the countries that are in the greatest need of food aid are also the countries whose economies are probably the most they have the lowest type of economy.
Uh-huh.
And oftentimes their currency is not readily convertible into dollars. It has very low value. So that if you sell the product in that country for that country's currency, you can't really convert it back to U.S. dollars and bring those funds back to the U.S. So the significance of that is now you can sell it in dollars and bring those dollars back or move the dollars around, actually, to other countries. The basic change in the food aid program is the McGovern-Dole International Food for Education and Child Nutrition Program. It's funded at $100 million for this fiscal year, and the appropriations would be authorized thereafter in terms of they haven't specified the appropriations into the future. Now, what this program is it actually is based on the concept of the U.S. school lunch program. And the idea is to both provide nutrition or food to school children in developing countries that need it, but also provide doubly an incentive for parents to send their kids to school. Because in a lot of cases in developing countries, the economic situation is such that kids will be sent off to work as soon as they can, and because this is a sheer economic necessity. So this is a way of providing kind of an incentive in terms of having the food available at the school for parents to send in schools. And this is a brand new program. It's being implemented now basically around the world.
Interesting.
Now I'm going to do a transition to talking about the Foreign Agricultural Service, and you'll hear some overlap to what I just talked about in terms of the Farm Bill, because we are set up basically the way the Farm Bill has set us up. But the Foreign Agricultural Service is the lead agency at USDA for international trade and international market development. And in terms of the organizational structure of the agency, we are set up essentially into four pieces plus our overseas offices. We have over 75 offices overseas. These are agricultural attaché offices and agricultural trade offices overseas. And they are our principal linkage to markets overseas. We are also responsible for international trade policy negotiations. And this is something that is unique to agriculture because in all other services and products, the U.S. Trade Representative Office, USTR, has the principal responsibility for trade negotiations. But in the case of agriculture, it is actually USDA and the U.S. Trade Representative's Office that have responsibility for agriculture. This is very important for the U.S. agriculture sector because USDA has only one jurisdiction, one focus, and that's agriculture in terms of trade negotiations. The U.S. Trade Representative's office has everything else plus agriculture. So our focus is always going to be dedicated to the cause of U.S. agriculture, which is an important distinction to make. Another facet or part of the agency in terms structurally is what we call the commodity CMP, commodity and market programs, and that is the part of the agency that administers the market access program, which I just briefly talked about, and focuses on export market development. I talked about export finance insurance, and that's handled under what we call export credits, another part of the agency. And then the food technical assistance and food security in developing countries is to be the fourth program area or segment of the agency.
Robert, a quick question for you in regards to the overseas technical assistance and food aid programs. The Food for Peace program, was any of that involved in Iraq or any of these states that have been identified as terrorist states, Iran, Syria, North Korea? Mm-hmm. I know we've had levels of assistance to all of those countries. Where do they fall in what you guys do?
Well, in terms of Iraq, actually what's happening now is that there's clearly a need for food aid, food assistance going into Iraq. So the department is in the process now putting together I guess you could call it a task force to handle the issue of food aid. And in fact, in reference back to Oregon, if there are companies who are interested in potentially participating in the food aid program for Iraq, I would actually work with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and then through me and FAS in terms of referring those companies to what we'll develop in terms of as they decide how that's going to be handled.
Do you have a time frame that you have to work under in that regard?
No, there isn't.
There isn't. No time. Okay.
This is an evolving project, obviously, because of the needs over there.
And have we been doing that in Afghanistan also?
Yeah, there's a food aid program in Afghanistan. In fact, I guess this would be about almost a year ago. Had you seen the news pictures of there were actually these yellow packages of food that were airdropped.
Yeah, right.
That food aid, that is actually part of the food aid program and was administered by FAS, a portion of FAS. Now, we don't actually deliver the food aid. We actually just administer the financial part of it, and then it is literally contracted out to the food companies.
And this is something that's outside of what the UN does?
Yes. Okay. This is a U.S. program. U.S. program.
Are there other countries that are doing similar things, have similar programs of foreign food aid?
Mm-hmm.
They do? Okay.
Yeah, there are some other countries as well. Okay. The food aid, the PL480 food aid program actually dates back to the 1950s. So it is a long-standing program and has been reauthorized every 7 years in the U.S. in the different farm bills.
So if there were Oregon companies that wanted to move food to Iraq or Afghanistan, any of these countries where there's a focus now,
mm-hmm.
That we could work through ODA then to direct them to work with
right.
you to
and
see what opportunities.
And refer those companies. And okay. I can't guarantee that any one company would necessarily be able to specifically participate in the program. I don't administer that
right.
part. But they probably right now are looking for companies, and actually I've been told to sort of basically collect the names of companies and refer them on within the department.
Okay, and you would have, John would have some criteria of the types of foodstuffs and those types of things they're looking for?
Well, actually, we could just take the companies. What would be helpful is if the companies have their name and identify the type of products they have,
okay.
and then you try
okay.
to work the match.
Okay,
for
I see.
Essentially, because there's probably a whole range of opportunities that are there.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
Mm-hmm. I talked about the overseas offices, which we have our attaché offices and our ATO, agricultural trade offices. One of the other things that they do overseas is they produce a lot of reports on the markets overseas, and this in fact is how we identify where the opportunities are for U.S. products. There are probably literally hundreds of reports that come in over the course of a year. We have coverage of more than 200 countries from those 75 offices overseas. And so if there is a market, there is someone writing a report on those opportunities. And one of the pieces of advice that we give to companies going, if they're thinking of going overseas, is that pick the country that you're interested in, see if there's an FAS office in that country, and try to schedule a meeting with the ag attaché or the agricultural trade officer who can give you a briefing on the current market conditions. And there's no better briefing than you can get from someone who actually literally lives in the country. That briefing will be much more up-to-date than an actual report which comes in. And oftentimes, they can provide some assistance and give some leads on potential buyers or importers of the person's product. So that's a service that FAS provides. And FAS has worked actually very closely with the Oregon Department of Agriculture when they're working with their companies in terms of making that link around the world. On the trade policy side, these are some of the major issues that we deal with in international trade policy. The first is the WTO, a World Trade Organization. The WTO talks for agriculture have started about a year ago, and we expect them to go on for at least another 3 years. And so at the end, of course, what we would like to see are some significant changes in reduction of agricultural trade barriers. The average tariff around the world is around 50 to 62%, in terms of averaged around the world for agricultural products. For the U.S. tariffs, it's down around 10 to 12%. So what our goal is to bring the rest of the world to our level. It's essentially the goal. So that is one sort of very broadly defined aspect of what we're looking at.
I've had the experience of being back and meeting with Ambassador Johnson from the U.S. Trade Rep's office, and you know, with a number of other legislators talking with him and Christine Sevilla about some of the issues revolving around trade and specialty crops and illegal dumping of various commodities, specialty crops in the United States of America. So when you're negotiating, what is your role as the Foreign Ag Service with the USTR's office in some of these tariff issues as it relates to the importation of foods or exporting from our country? Mm-hmm. What do you just advise them and they actually do the negotiating, or do you work together on that?
They do the negotiations together. So it would be persons from the Foreign Agricultural Service and the U.S. Trade Representative's Office negotiating together. Now, what happens with these negotiations is they take place over a period of 5 to 7 years. The last round, I think, took almost 10 years. And there are constant negotiations on different issues. There are certain issues which in the past have been fairly intractable issues. They are being raised again. And you work these, and it's almost glacial, probably, the progress that you would see on a day-to-day basis, but they keep working at it. But it is an official U.S. government position, which is USTR and USDA combined together. Part of our role in terms of FAS is to keep our focus on the ag side. One of the differences is that USTR, you know, since they have coverage of everything else, they will look at all of the different pieces together. And whereas ours, we can, just because we're solely focused on agriculture, you know, we're going to keep, I guess you could say, I can do this on the turf side, you know, we'll try to keep USDR in line, I guess, to keep pushing for agriculture. They probably won't like me to hear saying that. But there's also bilateral and regional trade negotiations that go on at the same time. One of the regional trade negotiations for agriculture that's going on now is CAFTA, or the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And that agreement is probably at least a couple. It's going on. It's just sort of they started going in full force probably within the last month. And I don't know what the exit time limit is for that. But that's a regional agreement which is part of what you could call a NAFTA extension that would bring in the Central American countries under the sort of umbrella of freer trade. Bilateral agreements, in the past we had a bilateral agreement with China, which is only about 3 or 4 years ago, on agriculture, and that negotiations took more than 10 years to come to a conclusion. Prior to that, if you go back to the 1980s, there were bilateral agreements with Japan, which opened the market in Japan for U.S. beef and U.S. citrus. So those agreements do have specific impact. The primary focus, of course, on these trade agreements is to look at tariffs and quotas. But then what has happened more recently is are the non-tariff trade barriers, which a lot of which are the SPS, or sanitary and phytosanitary barriers, which you're probably familiar with.
Unfortunately, numerous Oregon commodities have had that that circumstance brought upon them by foreign countries, and it costs us a lot of money as individual trade associations to fight that battle, and that's where the Foreign Ag Service and the USTR's office is really valuable to us in terms of once we raise that red flag to you, because you quite often don't know these things are occurring until after the fact. You have to go to bat for us.
Right.
It's critical.
And that's where it's actually it's very important to know that USDA and FAS does work on those SPS trade barriers and to bring that to the attention of FAS, because there are so many different issues going on at any one time. If you do find one of those issues, don't assume that we know about it in order to deal with it. So bring it to the attention of FAS. And we really don't mind how many times you bring it to the attention of FAS. It helps us actually focus on it. One of the other things that FAS, and through its international trade policy, does have are the foreign country import requirements. And these are the technical requirements, the food additive laws, labeling laws, pesticide residue requirements, and food sanitation laws. And that is accessible at FAS. A lot of that information actually is available through the FAS website, so you are not dependent upon trying to figure out that three-hour time difference between Oregon and Washington, D.C., or Oregon and Tokyo, or Oregon and London. You can access a lot of that information, and more of it all the time is placed on the website. The other part of FAS, which I talked about before, export credits, which does handle export financing and insurance. A little more detail in terms of the names of some of the programs. The transactional insurance programs, there's the Export Credit Guarantee Program, which has the meaningless initials of GSM 102 and 103. It stands for General Sales Manager. It doesn't mean anything in terms of the description of a program. It is it's probably a very good example of government bureaucraties of creating an acronym that means nothing. And I talked about the Supplier Credit Guarantee Program, which is focused on promissory notes, which for each of these programs is intended to fit the users will basically figure out which program fits for them. If you use letters of credit, you might be able to access the GSM 102 or 103 programs, and those are 5 to 7 year loan affects 5 to 7 year financing, or short-term financing that's basically cash basis. That's a supplier credit program. The facility guarantee program, it's a relatively new program. It was created 2 farm bills ago, is one way to describe it. And it's a similar transaction insurance program, but for a facility that will that we feel that U.S. agricultural products will flow through. So in other words, if you make up an example, if you were in the Philippines and they did not have a cold storage warehouse for fruits and vegetables that landed in Manila, you could use that program to potentially help finance or guarantee financing of a cold storage warehouse and the equipment, the refrigeration equipment that would go in there, if you can show that is intended for U.S. fruits and vegetable products going in there. So it would speed up a development that otherwise might not occur and would benefit U.S. exports in the longer term. That is a summary of all those programs that we'll skip through here. On the market development side, I already talked about a lot of these programs, so let me go through real quickly. There, the Market Access Program, the Emerging Markets Program, Technical Assistance for Specialty Crops I talked about. There is a Quality Samples Program, and that program actually goes back to the question that you had asked about the food aid programs,
right,
and the sale in dollars of local currency. Well, the Quality Samples Program actually runs off of the local currency derived from some of these food aid sales. So say in the, for example, you're in Morocco, and you have food aid that went to Morocco, and you have the local currency, which isn't brought back to the U.S. That local currency can be used then to finance sending samples, the cost of it in that country, and small sort of projects in that country where you're using strictly the local currency. You don't have to convert to U.S. dollars, where some of that comes from. Again, on the market development side, FAS produces this whole range of reports. FAS also works on trade shows, both international and domestic. So there are international trade shows which FAS either endorses or will, through the Market Access Program, assist U.S. companies in going to. Some of the large international trade shows have a U.S. pavilion organized under the U.S. umbrella, organized by FAS. So what you can have is either individual companies or states with companies organized under a U.S. flag pavilion in a trade show. There are also domestic trade shows that FAS participates in and works with states to bring companies into there. And the reason why we look at some of those domestic shows is there are foreign buyers who come in.
I see. Okay.
One example, the Food Marketing Institute trade show in Chicago, which is in about 2 weeks. We have a large international section to that show, and there are literally thousands of foreign buyers that are brought in to a show like that. FAS also organizes trade missions both out and in to the country as well. Of course, this gets to the point of why we do what we do with all of this in terms of these programs, the services, the infrastructure that FAS has around the world. And one of the questions, and you hear a lot of it, this discussion more recently, is people talk about the global economy and how it's new and just arrived and the impact of that. But from a global perspective, U.S. agriculture has been part of the global economy for 25, 50 years, actually the whole history. If you go back and look at the history of the United States, U.S. agriculture has always been a participant in what you today would call the global economy. In 2002, U.S. food and agricultural exports reached $53 billion. That in turn supported approximately 740,000 jobs. And when you break it out in terms of the importance, roughly a third of the U.S. crop acreage, what is planted, those products find their way into the export market, either directly or indirectly. And it's the estimate of the department that about a quarter of farm income comes from exports. So the way I translate that is to ask the question, how many people could afford to give up a quarter of their income? And nobody puts up their hands. And even Bill Gates probably wouldn't put up his hand voluntarily. But that's how important exports are. And the thing to remember is that the U.S. agriculture economy is much more export-dependent than the national economy. That's why part of the reason why we have FAS with its responsibility for trade negotiations, why you have it at USDA, that interest. Because if you look on that chart there, you'll see again the agricultural economy, 25% is relying on export. The overall U.S. economy, and you see pretty good across, only 10%. Another way to look at the importance of exports to U.S. agriculture is to take a look at products where 25% or more of those products are exported. And this chart up here on the right gives you an example of some of the products. You have everything from almonds, where two-thirds of the almonds produced are exported, all the way down to pulses or beans, where it's about 30%. There's about almost 50% for wheat, for here, relating back here to Oregon. But you have this whole range of products, from almonds to walnuts to rice to wheat, cotton, all of those, very high percentage, more than 25%, exported. Another way to look at it is $1 billion or more. And that chart there gives you a summary from soybeans, where it's more than $6 billion in exports, of course, grains, about the same amount, all the way down to dairy products, $1 billion or more in products. And then if we break it in, that's the same thing in a smaller category. If you look at consumer foods, you see $5 billion or more of red meat being exported, $2 billion in processed fruit and vegetables, $2 billion in fresh fruit, almost $2 billion in poultry, $1.6 billion in snack foods, $1.2 billion in fresh vegetables, $1.2 billion in tree nuts. A lot of those products are produced here in Oregon, so there's a significant export market for those products. And then, again, on the bulk commodity products, you see the range there, the high end, soybeans and coarse grains in the $5 billion range, wheat in the $3 billion range, feed and fodder in almost the $2 billion range. And one way to think about that is that there was Senator Everett Dirksen, who was senator from Illinois back in the 1960s and 70s, and he wasn't talking about agricultural exports, but I think he was talking about actually the federal budget. But one of his comments, famous comments, was, you know, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you have real money. Well, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you have $53 billion in U.S. agricultural exports. So it's very significant to the U.S. ag economy.
Robert, do you have a breakdown, and I guess maybe I should ask John, as to how our Oregon crops, what percentages of those are being exported? Clearly we see wheat, but all of the other crops that we grow here in Oregon are specialty crops.
For the record, John Szczepański, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Representative Krupp. We do have that data. I don't have it today for the presentation, but could provide that for you.
That's fine. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Now, I've gone through all this talking about the, you know, the positive side in terms of, you know, the dependency and those markets we have. But one of the reality checks that we have is that while 96% of the potential consumers or buyers of U.S. agricultural products live outside the U.S., only 10% of U.S. food companies actually export. So the challenge is to raise, if you just did that from 10 to 20%, you could obviously see a greater flow of product from the outside. So part of the challenge that's there, so we have not saturated the market in terms of finding the U.S. companies to export. So part of our challenge in FAS and working with the Oregon Department of Agriculture here is to find those companies, find the companies with the products, find the companies with the means to export, find the companies and help educate them and how to export, and match the markets to them as part of the challenge that is there for us. Now, if we look at also, I want to show you some of the changes that have occurred in the last quarter century, because there's some significant changes. 25 years ago, if you were to ask, and I guess we're here in Oregon, so I'm going to pick on New York City. Probably if you were to ask the average New Yorker, I'm assuming no one here is actually from New York City, but you know, if you were to ask the average New Yorker what's agriculture, they would probably tell you corn, wheat, soybeans, maybe cotton. And that actually would have been a very accurate definition of the composition of U.S. agricultural exports 25 years ago.
Yeah.
75% of U.S. agricultural exports 25 years ago were bulk commodity products. But what has happened in the last quarter century is the shift to what we call consumer-oriented or consumer food products, to the point where now consumer food products is now the largest share, 41%. Now, consumer food products, the easy way to think about what that is what you see in the supermarket. It's beef, it's pizza, it's dog food, it's snack foods, it's all those products that you see in the supermarket. And the shift towards that, in fact, that 41% of consumer foods is roughly about $22 billion last year, which was a record, is, when you look on this chart, is greater than the total in 1975. It's that sort of shift that has gone on. It is a very positive development. And, in fact, if you look at the growth areas, the high percentage growth categories, 15 out of 20 of the fastest growing categories over the last 3 to 5 years are consumer foods. You see on that chart there, it illustrates from pet food, which grew at a 14% annual rate averaged, all the way down to eggs, which is around 4%. But you see most of those products illustrated on that chart are actually consumer food.
Now, Robert, any reason why pet food would be the fastest growing category?
We actually had a lot of discussion about this. And at one point in the early stages of that growth, we saw, and this is before the collapse of the Soviet Union or the Eastern Bloc, whatever you want to call it, or right after, it was around that time, and we saw a high percentage growth of pet food exports to Poland. And there was a lot of speculation as to why that was, and this was like very small numbers. And part of the speculation was, and I think it's this is an urban legend tale, that because it was actually cat food that was going. And someone claimed that there were these elderly ladies having these teas, and they were serving cat food as pâtés because they like pâtés in Europe. I don't know whether that's true or not, but for pet food is that actually it's a reflection of affluence.
Yes,
it tells you the growth of a middle class around
the world.
We found exports going up for because the pet food that is going out, it is not your generic low-end pet food. A lot of it is very high-end premium pet food. And so it's telling you, and it's going to China. We saw the growth in China.
Wow.
And even when they may have changed the laws, but it used to be illegal to actually have a pet or a dog in China. But then there was pet food going over there to that market. It's a reflection of affluence there. Went to Mexico. One of the things about Mexico, Mexico, of course, in the past, about every 6 years, they would have an economic crisis, and exports would drop as a result of that economic crisis. The two previous economic crises they had in Mexico, one of the things that I noticed as an analyst was that pet food exports never dropped. The growth might have slowed, but it never actually dropped, and even with when the peso would devaluate each time. So our speculation was that a lot of people owned guard dogs and they had to keep them fed. But we have found like a growth around the world for that. Now, part of it, I believe, is because dog food in particular is a byproduct of the meat industry. And because we have such a large meat industry in the U.S., we have a relatively inexpensive byproduct turned into dog food, plus the grains, is probably a result of some of that.
Fascinating. It's fascinating.
One of the other changes that's happened at the same time over the last quarter century is a shift in where the markets are. If you look at this chart, traditionally, 25 years ago, most people thought of Europe as the principal market, and it was about 31% in terms of export share 25 years ago. But what has happened over the last 25 years are actually two significant trends that have occurred in parallel. It's the growth of the Pacific Rim as an export market and the growth of North America or the NAFTA market, because we define geographically incorrectly North America as Canada and Mexico, not the rest, to illustrate our point. But what you've seen here is now the Pacific Rim and North America were one-third the exports 25 years ago. It's now two-thirds. And it'll probably stay that way or, in fact, increase. That growth you can attribute to, one, trade agreements that went into effect. One is NAFTA, this shift here of North America from this $2 billion or 9% to $16 billion, and 30% can be directly attributed to NAFTA opening the markets. The growth of the Pacific Rim could be attributed to both trade agreements, either individual ones, like I referred to the Japan Beef Citrus Accord that occurred back in the 80s before, but also the growth of a middle class in a lot of the countries throughout Asia open up those markets. And so you see this kind of shift in terms of where these markets are over time. If you take a look at it another way, you can actually see here in terms of Okay, for the Pacific Rim, in terms of dollars, it's grown. This drop here represents, you can clearly see the impact of the economic crisis in Asia here. But if you look here for North America, this is the growth of the NAFTA market here. That was the last peso crisis in Mexico, but you see continued growth in terms of dollars here. As a share or percentage basis, you can see this kind of growth here. In point of fact, if it weren't for the high percentage growth of the NAFTA market over the last, especially 3 years, when you had this sort of downturn in Asia, we might have seen significant drops overall in U.S. agricultural exports, so that the dynamics of the NAFTA market has actually carried our U.S. exports.
And that's another way, you know, in terms of the dollar value growth in exports to the North American market grew 8 times. The Pacific Rim market, which is the largest regional market, grew 4 times. The EU remains, but because of the much faster growth elsewhere, it tends to diminish as a share of the total. Another way to look at the benefits of agricultural exports, it's not just the $53 billion in terms of exports that are a benefit to the U.S. When you look at the additional economic activity generated, what you find is, and roughly speaking, it's for each $1 billion in agricultural exports, another $1.5 billion of additional economic activity is generated here in the U.S. So on this chart here, I'm showing, and this is using the fiscal year 2000 numbers, when U.S. agricultural exports were about $52 billion. According to the Economic Research Service at USDA, another almost $76 billion in additional business activity was generated inside the U.S. Now, I talked before about this rise of consumer foods and why it was a positive thing, and this aspect where consumer foods now is the largest segment. If you take that and look at the additional contribution to the economy from exports, high-value products or consumer foods contribute more in additional economic activity than bulk commodity products. And this chart shows here, okay, this is value-added products, $1.63 per dollar of exports versus $1.18. It's about almost 40% more. Now, it actually logically makes sense because you've captured the value added inside the U.S. And one way to look at it is if we use the example of meat, because all meat really is, it's feed grain on 4 legs or 2 legs, right? You just converted it. It's corn, soybeans, and whatever else you might be feeding in there. Now, on one of those charts I showed, there's about an average of about $5 billion of red meat exports a year. If you could take that $5 billion, if you figure out the value, which I actually have done, of the feed grain that it took to produce that $5 billion in exports, and you just exported the value of the feed grain, it works out to about $1.2 billion of feed grain. So the choice is this. You export and get $1.2 billion for the feed grain, or you export and get more than $5 billion for the feed grain, but it's been converted into meat. The difference is the value-added part. The additional benefit for us in the U.S. to export these value-added products is we have captured it here inside the U.S. economy. So that's why that trend towards consumer foods is a positive development, and it's a much greater contribution inside the U.S. economy. Another way to look at it, and I talked about jobs and the 740,000 jobs that the Economic Research Service has estimated are supported by agricultural exports. When you're speaking with your colleagues who are urban, suburban colleagues, and I have found, oftentimes someone from an urban, suburban area might say, you know, why should I care about agriculture because they don't grow anything in my district? You're probably here in Oregon, you may be less, I don't know if you're likely to have that kind of response.
But some places.
Some places. But in Michigan, in Detroit, in Kansas City, in New York City, you do get actually quite literally that response. Well, my response back is if you look at those 740,000 jobs, 2/3 of those jobs are urban suburban jobs that are out there, whose jobs in food processing and other manufacturing related to food processing, there's services, there's trade, and there's transportation. If you're looking at transportation, you're looking at ports, you're looking at railroads, you're looking at air cargo. All of those jobs, a lot of those jobs, are urban, suburban type jobs. So for someone who thinks that they don't have a stake, a direct stake, in terms of their constituents, that actually is inaccurate. You can point out that there are these jobs that are urban, suburban jobs that are tied to exports. Therefore, they should be supporting programs and resources dedicated on the agriculture side for exports. And I'd like to finish with, we call this our missile strike chart, but it's because of the way it looks. But this chart symbolically, it's probably not a great thing to say, call it the missile strike chart, but you know, we're dropping our food aid packages. But symbolically, that actually, what that chart does is it captures FAS and its working relationship with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Symbolically, we have our 75 offices overseas, so that's what those lines are out there. And FAS, which has no domestic offices outside of Washington, D.C., so the lines go into D.C. and then go out to our state agriculture department partners. That we do not work directly with companies. We depend entirely on the state agriculture departments to work as our domestic partner in finding the companies, working with them, getting them into the market access program, and accessing all the different services and programs that FAS has to offer. But without an active state agriculture department in terms of their marketing people, nothing happens in that particular state. And there are all these resources that actually are leveraged by the state agriculture departments in terms of if you don't have the personnel and the programs within the state to access the market access program, to do trade shows, to use those services in the FAS offices overseas, then it doesn't happen for that particular state. One of the things that for FAS, you know, we have worked with the Oregon Department of Agriculture much longer than I have been there, but actually during my tenure and very early on in my career in FAS, I had the opportunity to come out and meet with the folks in the marketing part of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So I can say, I can attest personally that actually that Oregon is one of the states which I always think of as a model for other states in terms of having dedicated the resources, having assembled the expertise, and kept the focus on developing the export markets for Oregon, and there in turn overall for the U.S. So the Oregon Department of Agriculture is actually a key partner for FAS in developing those markets. So I'll conclude with that.
Very good. Thank you. That's most informative in regards to, I guess, showing us what the reach and the extent of your office is and what you're able to do in terms of through the Department of Agriculture for us here in Oregon. I would tell you my own personal experience in having taken a marketing trip with some Oregon growers who were producing value-added products, going with Mr. Shapinski to Japan and seeing how those products were being received, distributed, and sold throughout Japan. It was a very eye-opening experience to see the real potential I think there is for value-added, and that's why I'm glad to see that in the marketing. In the Farm Bill, there's a lot of dollars there. That market assistance increase in dollars from $93 million to $200 million is a key to, I think, us being able to compete in a world market that is very difficult to compete in right now in many ways. John, welcome. What are you going to share with us today?
Representative, members of the committee, I'd like to just kind of piggyback on some of Robert's comments with a very brief description of how the state of Oregon leverages those resources provided by the USDA Foreign Ag Service. And let me just start off by talking about how Oregon agriculture is significant, how it's diverse, and how it's export dependent. In terms of significance, Just to highlight facts that perhaps some of you already know, the farm gate value over $3 million with another $2 billion in terms of value-added processing. When you consider the various jobs related to and the different industries connected to agriculture, agriculture in our state represents 9% of the gross state product and about one out of every 12 jobs in the state. Mm-hmm. We have 40,000 producers across the state managing 17.5 million acres of land. That's about half of all the private land in the state is in the stewardship of agricultural producers. And 86% sole proprietor, family-owned businesses. These are entrepreneurs. These are distinctly American people. Oregon agriculture is diverse. If we look a little bit eastward, we see a typically agricultural state like Iowa, where 95% of the state's agriculture's value is represented by just four commodities. In Oregon, 95% of the state's value would be represented by over 100 commodities. In fact, in total, we have 250 commodities, 20 of which are valued at over $20 million each. A very diverse agriculture is Oregon. But also to keep in mind that Oregon agriculture is export-focused. 80% of agriculture leaves the state. That's good because it means we get dollars into the state. It's not a case of moving money from one pocket to another. We're bringing export dollars in, even though those export dollars might be coming from California or New York State. In fact, 45% of Oregon agricultural's value is achieved from outside the country. The country of Japan, that is the Japanese consumers, in some years buy more Oregon agriculture than Oregonians themselves purchase. Exports account for about 20% of Oregon's export value, making agriculture the number two export product in the state behind high tech. And the Port of Portland is itself dependent upon agriculture, with 60% of the volume represented by agriculture. So agriculture in the state is significant, diverse, and export dependent. And it is no exaggeration to talk about the partnership that we have with the USDA Foreign Ag Service that we're dependent upon for building capacity in our state as well as building markets. And they help us achieve three of our main missions, linking farm to market, interweaving the marketing and development functions, as well as adding value to agriculture. And I'll cover some of these. But first, a little plug for our department in terms of leveraging the federal resources of the FAS with a record of international leadership with a lot of firsts. The first ever state to export live seafood to the Far East. The first state ever to ship fresh blueberries to the United Kingdom and Japan. Many other firsts, including what this picture represents, is Oregon grass seed now growing in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is link the farm to market, making what's relevant in a blueberry farm in Hillsboro connected to what's happening at a trade promotion in Tokyo. We do many different things to link farm to market through technical seminars, both conducted in market as well as via satellite, in which case this picture represents a virtual tasting in which we had people assembled here in Oregon communicating via satellite live, talking to customers in Japan and Korea. As Robert talked about, we host incoming trade missions with FAS partnership as well as participating in trade shows. One of the key things is we tap into the FAS global market to understand and anticipate food trends. Last year, we developed a relationship with 17 Japanese retailers, representing total sales of $3.8 billion. We use this network to develop understanding of what's happening in the market so that we can understand the latest development.
You weren't kidding about the pictures, were you,
Transportation, Tom? Transportation, packaging, and development.
Thank you.
There, your leadership was especially...
Yeah, I hope that's all you have.
And as well, it's to understand and monitor the regulatory environment. to enhance the competitiveness of Oregon agriculture. Here's a picture of a round steak selling for about $27 a pound, carrying a 10-digit identification code that links this piece of meat in a Japanese grocery store to the ear tag from the animal from which it came. A response that the Japanese government spent $2 billion in response to its own mad cow scare, and which we understand and will follow up shortly, which will soon be required of American exporters trying to get their beef products into Japan. 10-digit code linking steak to cattle.
So John, if I'm understanding, what we suspected on our trip last October is now coming to fruition, that the Japanese want to extend this 10-digit barcode requirement to any imported beef product, correct?
Representative, that's true. In fact, yesterday from Mr. Hanawa in Tokyo, the gentleman
yes.
with whom you met,
Hanawa-san,
received an email saying that seemed to be the indication by the Japanese government.
Marvelous.
As well.
Can the FAS help us with that?
Actually, Senator FAS is working on that issue.
Okay. Good.
The Oregon Department of Agriculture, in partnership with industry, as well as the Oregon State University Land-Grant Institution, have developed a very strong market for the in China for Oregon grass seed, representing over 20 million pounds, $11 million in delivered sales. And Oregon now has a 60-some percent market share in China compared to about 10 years ago. 1994, in fact, New Zealand had the leading share in the Chinese grass seed market. We also help to interweave marketing with development functions. Here's a case of Oregon Brand Seafood, an unused processing facility in Charleston, with a photograph there on the right-hand side of the much maligned hagfish, also known by its equally unappealing name, slime eel. It's what we call in agriculture an underutilized species, underappreciated by us in the United States, but of distinct value to some markets. The slime eel, bottom-feeding animal that has not changed its biology in a couple million years, no eyes, seven hearts. But apparently, according to the Koreans, kind of tasty with a light soy sauce.
John, we're not in any danger of us harvesting so many of those they become extinct or on the threatened endangered list?
Representative, no, I do not believe that's the case.
Good to know.
What we saw with this market opportunity, with contacts developed through FAS trade shows, we found an investor willing to develop this unused facility in Charleston to bring jobs to the region. We brought some of the fishermen to the Korean market, bringing those producers to market and developing marketers. And what we have today is investment going on of over $1 million, representing what should be, what it will by next year be about 50 jobs, making that facility, Charleston, actually Coos County's largest private employer, and over $2 million in annual sales. A great example, and our most recent example, in fact, of interweaving marketing with development functions. But there's also the efforts that we have in adding value to agriculture, such as a quarantine station, which is being developed now with a former Farm Bill monies as well as FAS market promotion funds in order to supply live cattle to Korea. And in August, we're planning 861 head of cattle to go over there. An interesting development that if the cattle raised in the United States spend 180 days in Korea, they get what is the equivalent of a Korean citizenship and can be sold on the Korean market for 3 to 4 times their value. And it was something that we took a trade team to Korea recently looking at, and as well the feed that the Korean cattle, that is the American cattle going over to Korea, the feed is actually coming from Oregon itself. We add value in other ways. The list of achievements I mentioned in many ways talk about the the rare ability of the Department of Agriculture here in Oregon to work with our divisions and develop scientific protocols to open markets. What we see is the potato market opened in Taiwan because protocols developed there by our food safety and plant and plant divisions, as well as markets open for blueberries, as well as live seafood. This is basically what we're not, and this represents kind of the death of the salesman. This is the Willie Loman model of the salesman that shows up on a doorstep with a suitcase loaded full of products and says, "Hey, I'm ready to sell." And this, frankly, is not what marketing is about. And what we are trying to develop in our program and using the resources of FAS is developing a marketing program that has a strong understanding of our customers, of our products, and the processes that make those products. The road ahead, some of the activities that we plan, many in partnership with FAS and leveraging the resources of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, looking at many different projects in and around the world, including a new production facility for those lovely slime eels in Brookings, looking at wine sales in Japan and Korea, as well as the Korean food service program. And that's it for my talk. And certainly Robert and I are available for any questions.
Very good. Good stuff. Kind of some innovative things. Representative Smith, you look pained.
What did you do with a slime eel?
Eat it. It's a delicacy in Korea. Slime eel. I didn't know we had such a thing off the Oregon coast. I think it's... I did want to ask you one question about the quarantine facility for cattle. That is for Oregon cattle or for any American cattle being exported to Korea.
Representative, currently that would be the case for any American cattle.
That's right.
And with a lot of our projects, what we're doing is developing the capacity for those market opportunities such that Oregon product could eventually go through that quarantine station. But I believe most of the cattle going this summer would be coming from other states through Oregon.
And when did you, Robert, since the Farm Bill became actually law and was funded, how soon were dollars available for us to work in partnership with the FAS, or ODA to work with the FAS?
Well, the increase in the market access program that you referred to, that first increase is actually available this fiscal year. So
yes.
Almost right away.
So the money is just now becoming available
right.
From the Farm Bill. It's taken that length of
right.
time.
Right. Where there are existing programs, is actually what you see is just a continuation. Where there are changes in either new programs or they've increased the funding, that, well, particularly with the increase in funding, actually, since Congress did not pass the new budget until about 2 months ago, and we wouldn't have seen a new funding for that come into play for this fiscal year. But what you're seeing is basically most of the Farm Bill is being implemented now, as we speak, or has been.
Members, questions, comments? You guys got off lucky today, huh? Robert, thanks for coming all the way out from D.C. Where do you go next?
I go back tomorrow, and then next week I'm in Seattle.
Wow. You travel a lot. How was your briefing in Pasco that we missed back? I think it was February you did that?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I was not there for that particular briefing. But in terms of for the overall Farm Bill, and you saw how big and comprehensive that bill is, if there are individual pieces of that Farm Bill that you have questions on and you would like to have someone from the department come out and talk to you in more detail about, let me know, because we can arrange for, particularly, you know, collect the different issues and have people from the different parts of the department come out and can set up an event that they can talk about those issues. Because you can see how I do not believe there is any one person in the department that actually can address in any kind of detail that Farm Bill, because it's so large. But as far as, you know, for what you are interested in, let me know, and we will work on something in the future.
Very good. Members, I want to share with you how important it is, and I'm going to put this pitch in for you all to be involved with our national legislative organizations, CSG, ALEC, NCSL. And I'll tell you why. Because I, along with a group of other legislators from other states, was part of the Agriculture Committee's meeting before the Farm Bill was totally negotiated, and paying particular attention to and asking for certain provisions be added into the Farm Bill regarding specialty crops. And there are new things in the Farm Bill today because of some of the efforts of myself and other individuals from states that are increasingly reliant on specialty crops now. And I give you the example of some of my legislator friends from Kentucky and other states that have diminishing tobacco fields and subsidies now are looking for high value at value-added crops that they can replace them with. And they have the same concerns that I do in regards to all of the Farm Bill focusing on just the Big 8 program crops and nothing being there substantive for the emerging value-added specialty crop market all across America. And this is why I want to encourage you to be involved, because I'm convinced that many of the additions that there are in the Farm Bill, opportunities now for specialty crops, are a direct result of legislators like myself going and being involved with these national organizations and putting together policy recommendations that we then went and lobbied our congressional members for. And I'm convinced that those are partly why some of those provisions are in the Farm Bill today. So I want to encourage you, whatever issue that is important, you be involved with those national legislative organizations, participate, go back to D.C. It's money well spent. It's time well spent, because you can make a difference, because I think we have, and I'm really glad to see some of those provisions in there. They're going to make a difference in Oregon. I'm convinced of that. And I'm glad to hear that we have an opportunity to get Oregon companies involved in your food aid programs to some of these war-torn countries, because it will, I believe, have a big impact on us in the future. And I thank you both very much. Appreciate it. Okay. With that, we're going to close the informational hearing on the U.S. Farm Bill. And members, we are going to focus next, very briefly, on fixing a small problem we had in a bill from last week. Just a small problem. And that is, we're going to need to address House Bill 3264, and the chair would entertain a motion from Representative Hunt to temporarily suspend the rules for the purposes of reconsidering House Bill 3264.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we temporarily suspend the rules to reconsider House Bill 3264.
Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair would also entertain a motion to adopt the related amendments. Okay. The chair would entertain a motion to reconsider the bill first. Representative Hunt.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider House Bill 3264.
Members, we're reconsidering House Bill 3264. Any objections? So ordered. Ray, we have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have Dash 2 amendment. I was just going through it, and Dash 2 amendment defines plan for an alternative practice, and it requires state forester to review written plans instead of approve written plans, as was discussed in the last committee hearing, which was held on the 18th of this month. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these Dash 2 amendments are the ones that I said we didn't have, that we found. We did find them. Anyway, they were fully discussed during the 18th hearing, and therefore the bill had to be brought back into committee to consider amending those things into the original measure, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to comment on the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3264? Come forward, please. Welcome, gentlemen, for the record.
Greg Klein, Department of Forestry, Forest Practices Director. I'm Lanny Quackenbush, Forest Practice Program Policy Manager.
Welcome. Your thoughts on the Dash 2s?
We've done a real quick run-through of the Dash 2 amendments and the ones that we requested about a week ago, and one of them was missed, and that was a request to drop one section towards the end of the bill. However, we don't think that's a critical flaw. If that one could be dropped, really with the change, it becomes a superfluous clause. But it, as such, if it stays in there, it's okay.
Well, we could.
Was I not here?
Could we possibly address that on the Senate side? Would be fairly simple. Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, OFIC. I've also reviewed the Dash 2 amendments and believe they're consistent with what the Forestry Department's intent was that we testified in full support of last Friday. So we, and the one item that was just mentioned is a minor thing. If it didn't get fixed at all, that would be okay. If we can fix it in the Senate, that's okay too. So I would hope that this could move forward today and appreciate the committee's perseverance on this issue. This is a very important issue.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I also appreciate the effort.
For the record.
Again, Greg Klein, Department of Forestry. Appreciate the effort of the chair and the committee to move this bill forward.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
May I ask a few questions?
Sure.
I apologize. I wasn't here for the hearing. And these have probably already been answered, but I'm just trying to get through and making sure I get all my specifics that my constituents are yelling at me about. Currently, then, not all forestry operations are required to have a written plan. So can you characterize to me what ones we do require under current law? What makes them different?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Worth, actually specifically two specific situations. One is if an operation is within 100 feet of waters of the state, and a second circumstance would be within 300 feet of a protected resource site, like a eagle nest, spotted owl nest site.
So,
yes.
And I see that we're taking out some of this. Require a plan, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, could I comment on that, Representative Worth? We're not removing the requirement to file written plans. This bill doesn't do that. The only change is the requirement that the state forester affirmatively approve written plans in these situations. Written plans are still going to be required. State forester is still going to be required to review the written plans and to advise the applicant as to whether or not the plan is consistent with the rules. And if it's he or she proceeds. Against that advice, he or she is going to get a ticket for violating the rule. So nothing substantive is changing. It's just the formal approval process.
So follow up, Mr.
Yes.
I'm just going to follow up on the way. So if the approval is not required by the state forester as it is today, then there's no approval at all required?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, for these written plans, that would remove that affirmative duty. And this bill, as was discussed, and if you have a copy of Ted Lawrence's testimony from Friday, is directly related to a federal lawsuit that the state is trying to defend against. The state forester is actually being sued for allegedly violating the Federal Endangered Species Act, and the causal connection is that by approving these plans, he's an agent of a sequence of events that leads to a violation of the Endangered Species Act. That lawsuit is not quite past the formal motion stage yet, and both the state of Oregon and the interveners, which includes us, have spent close to $1 million in legal fees already. That's what makes some sense of urgency to make this procedural change in this bill to deal with a pretty serious legal situation.
That puts it together for me. Thank you.
Any additional questions, members? Representative Smith.
I just have a quick question on the Dash 2s on page 4 where we've got number 14. And it says subject to approval by the state forester. Aren't we taking away the approval by state forester?
Where are you at, Representative?
On
which line?
Page 4, line 5.
Okay.
Line 4 and 5. Where it says subject to approval by the state forester. Isn't that, am I confused or is that counter?
Comment, please.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, specifically that's dealing with the definition of plan for an alternative practice.
Right.
again, that does require approval. That is not would not be considered a written plan.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have one quick question about that. I don't know what page it is, but it said something about the alternative plan. It's taken out the word written, and so I'm assuming that that means the alternative plan don't have to be submitted in writing. I'll find it. You're looking at me strange. Page 11, line 29, just says the board shall require that the words written then taken out plan for an alternative practice be submitted prior to approval.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, the specific there is it would be still a plan, but it would not have to be in written form. It could be orally done and then essentially approved in writing by a field forester.
Okay. Why don't you make that point, Ray? On the next page.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on page 12 of dash 2 amendments, line 1 and 2, it states that the board may establish by rule any additional standards applying to operations under this section. That would not preclude the board from passing a rule saying you need a written plan.
Yeah.
But it does leave it up to the board as to the process and procedure.
So page 11, Representative Worth, is deleting the requirement. The board shall require that a plan will be the new language, but in the second page it further establishes that the board could put additional standards in by rule.
I'm just wondering how they could do it because I'm writing.
Okay, additional questions, members?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify on the dash 2 amendments? Hearing none, the chair would entertain a motion, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Gilman. I move dash 2 amendments to 3264.
Hey, members, the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3264 have been moved. Discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Representative Gilman.
I move 3264 to the floor with a due pass, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gilman moves House Bill 3264 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Hearing none. Is there objection? Hearing none. So ordered, and the chair will be the carrier. Thank you all. We're going to close the work session, House Bill 3264. Thank you all for your patience. And I guess I just wish that the fine gentleman who presented us with the briefing on the Farm Bill had presented us with these, because I sat here and wrote notes on all of that. Oh, well, such as it goes. Very good. All right, let's open up a work session on House Bill 2754. Ray, do we have amendments to that bill?
Mr. Chair, I do not have amendments to the bill.
Then the bill stands as written?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the bill stands as written.
Stands as written. Is there anyone here who would like to comment on while we're in work session on House Bill 2754? Anything additional to say?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'm not here to oppose the bill, but I do want to want you to hear some concerns that we have, and perhaps you can hear the answers from the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and the Department of Agriculture to those concerns. Personally, I do not favor conservation easements on general principles. First, they tend to take productive lands out of production, and this kind of flies in the face of Oregon's land use laws, where the supporters of land use laws find that it's necessary to protect and mandate that these lands are for agriculture production, and yet conservation easements do a 180 on that. Secondly, conservation easements are usually forever. They're in perpetuity. And this is a what I call a landed servitude. It's an encroachment on the future uses of these lands. And in other words, if an heir receives these lands as a beneficiary in an inheritance, it virtually dictates from the grave as to the uses of those lands. However, having said that, this bill is not to address outlawing conservation easements. So as to the soil water conservation districts holding conservation easements, these are my concerns. Farmers and ranchers see the soil water conservation districts as a service agency, but not necessarily being in the business of encouraging conservation easements that take land out of production. Usually soil and water conservation districts are short of funds. We hear that all the time in this building. Conservation easements, the administration of conservation easements, certainly will take both personnel and money to do that. Third, soil and water conservation districts will be responsible for carrying out the compliance of the conservation agreement or slash contract, because it is a binding contract. To me, this carries a real liability that can be challenged in court, and if they're challenged in court, and I could give examples of what might happen, but I don't want to belabor with you unless you want that. But if it's challenged in court, who's going to pay? The liability for violation of carrying out the conservation easement contract could fall on the individual members of the Soil and Water Conservation District Board. And finally, what happens to a soil and water conservation district when it is holding a conservation easement and that SWCD might be abolished for various reasons, which, of course, could be lack of funds or a change in the law? Those are my concerns, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about that.
Thank you, Glenn. Members, do we have questions of Glenn on this issue? Well, since the experts are in the back of the room, Glenn, you do raise some interesting questions, and why don't we ask John McDonald and anyone else who'd like to address those questions to come forward and share your thoughts with us on that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We discussed this last time. I was asking for some clarification as to what this would mean to allow soil and water conservation districts to acquire highway scenic preservation easements. Did we get any information on that? It allows both.
It does?
Easements, yeah. And highway scenic preservation easements.
Okay. Let's go ahead and ask that question. John, welcome. Good to see you again. Why don't you address Representative Worth's question since you're first up? And for the record, state your name.
Okay, Chair Krupp and members of the committee, my name is John McDonald. I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I'm also a director, one of these people that would be around to manage a conservation easement if we so chose to hold one. I'm a director with the Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District that's in Washington County. And I'm also a landowner and a farmer, and wanting to make sure that those people that testified to you before are also handling hazelnuts when they're doing exports. So hopefully that's going on as well. I have given you a piece of paper that handles some information kind of as background stuff. This is partly at the request of the chair, who said, can you give us a few details? And I'll try to point out the things that I think are of most interest to districts. This is not the entire encyclopedia of conservation easements, but the basics are here, and some of the things that allow us to look at them as a flexible means and a flexible tool to deal with some of the concerns and objectives that landowners may have. In the first two paragraphs on the first page, obviously a conservation easement is a deed restriction. The important thing is it is voluntarily placed, where the landowner has asked to do this to protect natural resources, and that protection can be all kinds of things, anywhere from a wetlands to just protecting the land in production. and maintaining it for farm, forest, or ranch use. When it gets to that level, obviously we're changing the name slightly by calling it an agricultural conservation easement. That is the one to which we are addressing ourselves. That's the one conservation districts are most interested in doing. Mr. Stonebank brought up the idea that one of the concerns is that land is taken out of production. It was interesting to me when I heard him talking the other day on the phone about what the concerns were and talked with some of the members of their trust board, Mr. John Lillicrop, for one. I said, well, what are your concerns? And he said, well, we don't want land taken out of production, and we don't want this, and we don't want that. And I said, thank you. You exactly said what we want, too. That is what our concern is. We want land kept in production, but we also want the conservation concerns. And the conservation practices is a part of that land, and therefore, you know, with some landowners, obviously, we're going to work to have a conservation plan, because obviously some areas, things need to be improved in order to protect the natural resources, protect the soil, protect the wildlife, protect the wetlands, and so forth. The second part of that sentence is in the second paragraph, and that is, it is a legal agreement between a landowner and a holder. And what we're saying, and obviously why we're here before this committee, is we feel that in our law we have the authority to do this, but because there was a question raised by Attorney General's opinion that there might be a risk to the landowner, we have, as conservation districts, voluntarily not pursued this, you know, for about 6 years now, because we wanted to make sure that we were not going to put a landowner at risk. We're here actually to clarify the idea so we could go through with what might be the interest of a district and a landowner. This happened just one time, and the Department of Agriculture was the co-holder, and that's what made it, you know, a safe risk for the landowner. Under the general characteristics of the agricultural thing, there are some things I think that need to be seen. For example, they say that they're forever. That it's locked in there, whatever can be. Well, actually, you'll see the characteristics I've listed. They're very flexible. They can be tailored to do a lot of different things. They don't have to be on a whole piece of property. They can be on a very small piece of the property. They can be on one plot and not on all the acreage of the operation. The size can be small. The limitations can be varied. The time limit can be, you know, very short. It doesn't have to be perpetual. It can be a year. I think I've heard stated from experts that the average easement around the nation is about 25 years. So it doesn't necessarily put it in concrete forever. My other answer, however, to that is maybe a kind of a challenge back, and that is I see somebody selling their property to a land developer who puts up condominiums instead of trees, and I say, wait a minute, isn't that a very permanent change as far as the land use is concerned? So individuals have for, you know, decades and hundreds of years been making decisions that were fairly permanent as far as what you could do with that property after that period of time. Yes, they are legally binding on future landowners up to the time of the easement. That may be perpetual, it may not. There are ways that you can change it. Of course, eminent domain and a court ruling can actually come along after a period of time and saying that the value and the purpose of the easement can no longer be sustained. And so a court can remove that easement. You know, there are some flexibilities here. There are some latitudes here. Obviously, item number 9 is that you know, some holders would ask for a conservation plan, and obviously that would be something that we and probably even the NRCS people and so forth would assist us in developing. Item number 9 is that the land still stays on the tax rolls, still qualifies for programs and so forth. On the second page, you know, the land retains... And the landowner retains title. They can live on it, sell it, lease it, pass it on to heirs, restrict public access. You know, it's still their property. They can put it up for a loan. They do a lot of things. And it's hard to think that somehow everything changed on that property. Everything doesn't change on that property necessarily. You're putting a particular restriction. The restriction can be as simple as, I don't want this to be done, something, I don't want development to be done on this property. That may be all that the restriction is. It could be, you know, something very, very specific. That's why it's so flexible. We talked there about, on that second page again, about valuing and what the value is. And obviously there are some benefits to, you know, what the landowner can get. Tax benefits. There are some estate planning benefits. There may be even some actual direct capital, you know, influx there. We're not in the business of going out and trying to raise big bucks to buy conservation easements. I mean, there are certain kind of easements that districts just won't be able to get into. We're not going to go on and say, here's $1 million or something like that. We're going to take the ones where primarily the landowner wishes to donate it for an easement for their own personal gain, whatever that may be, through tax or estate planning. That doesn't preclude us from going to partners. And we actually have some, like the American Farmland Trust and some others I won't name, who said, we would be happy to give you money to buy the easement and let you be the holder. We just want the conservation benefit. I've talked to some of the larger ones saying, that's fine. We will help the landowner get some cash in that way, and then you can just go ahead and monitor the process. We also have some money which has just been authorized to Oregon, believe it or not, a little over $1 million, in the Farm and Rangeland Protection Program, that we have that to match against what some landowners can put up to build easements to protect farmland. So there are other ways to do this. Obviously, the value has to come through a qualified appraiser, as we say, and there are some other things. Let me call your attention to a couple items at the bottom of that page, particularly on the heading Potential Negative Attributes and this thing called Extra Responsibility and Workload. Again, I don't see conservation easements being a big item on every conservation district's agenda. I'm sorry, I just don't. I mean, we're giving them the right to do this by passing this bill, but I don't think they're going to be out there and say everybody's going to be out marketing conservation easements next year. I know that there are some people, for example, that have some districts that have permanent tax rates. They're going to be able to have the ongoing kind of staffing and so forth that they would be able to plan that workload on a regular, consistent basis. There are some other districts that are very, very strong and well-funded and doing great work, and they would have the confidence of being able to maintain. There are a few districts in this state that I would, frankly, if I heard they were planning to do one, I would be getting in my car and driving down there saying, do you really want to do this? Are you really ready for this? And I think the Department of Agriculture would be equally confident in trying to educate people to the point that maybe it wouldn't be the right thing for them to do at that time. We do a workload analysis every year. We sit down as a district and say, okay, here are the jobs we've taken on. And we actually plot out the number of hours and days that each staff person is assigned to each task, and each director is assigned to each task, and volunteers have agreed to perform in tasks, and the NRCS partners in the office have agreed to assist with certain tasks. And by the time you get down, we generally know what we're going to do, how much time it's going to take it, and whether we can fulfill those obligations. This would be a simple matter of that kind of planning that goes on every year. We turn it into the Department of Agriculture for assessment and review. And I think we'll be able to judge. And frankly, I think we directors are in a pretty good position to know what we can handle and what we can't. And we're not going to make a bunch of stupid mistakes, because obviously our primary responsibility is to serve the landowner and to protect the landowner. And if we're going to bite off something where we can't do that, then that runs against our very highest value of trying to be of service to the landowner. A couple of the items that have come up in addition to the taking land out of production, which is not our intent, as Len said, if they last forever, well, in some cases they will, but they don't have to. We are a service agency. Yes, we are. And I think this is an absolutely wonderful way to be of service. We work with a lot of landowners. We talk with them about their options. We want to be able to say, if we're talking about your options for conservation, for land preservation, for staying in business, for production preservation, why can't we also talk about maybe there's a farm bill program or a equip contract or a small grant or something. There's also an easement that might be an option. We need to be educated enough to be able to inform landowners, and if they choose that, and there's the key, if they choose, and we choose, it has to be an agreement of both parties, we might start to enter into a contract. In some cases, the landowner would say, no, I'm interested. In some cases, the district would have to say, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And I think that's a judgment that is on a case-by-case basis. If we're short of funds, well,
hate to say this because I don't want to mess up, you know, any appeal we might have in the budget process. We used to do a whole lot with a lot less money than we have now. We still kept our doors open. If we don't get a single dollar from the legislature for districts, believe it or not, districts still exist. We directors will still get together once a month. We directors will still work with the SB 1010 plans. We will still work with the NRCS people. We might be using them more as providing our technical assistance work. We will be using new provisions of the Farm Bill to hire, for example, technical service providers that are in the private arena to do the kind of planning and stuff that would come to us for approval to utilize Farm Bill funds. We're not going to go away. Now, the only way you could do that is to wipe out ORS 568 and totally get rid of all, you know, get rid of all conservation districts, and that would be a mistake because then you're, well, frankly, your channel through which the Farm Bill funds come and get onto the land is through districts. So, you know, that'd be kind of like shooting yourself in the foot. Administration does take personnel and money. Again, that's something you budget in and you plan for and you do what you can afford. Compliance and liability issues. Yes, we do understand that somebody can say, you know, can say we were not holding up our end as the holder's responsibility adequately. And that's where we rely upon the tort liability insurance we have paid by the Department of Agriculture, and I'll let them address how that could work.
Welcome, Chuck. Your thoughts?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chuck Craig, Deputy Director, Department of Ag. So the first point that I would make is the department has pretty firm oversight responsibility for the soil and water conservation districts under Chapter 568. And in fact, we have the authority to approve or disapprove any project or budget of a soil and water district. And what our intent would be to establish guidance either as strong policy direction or administrative rules for the districts in terms of implementing a program of conservation easements so that the kinds of things that are mentioned that can be of concern, and we certainly agree that taking land out of production is an issue. We don't want conservation easements doing that. But they can just as easily keep land in production when they're done properly. You can do beneficial conservation easements, and in fact, farm organizations and ranch organizations alike are very intrigued by the possibilities of being able to use conservation easements to preserve land in agriculture. As John McDonald mentioned, we provide the tort liability insurance for the Soil and Water Conservation District directors. They are all elected officials of political subdivisions of the state of Oregon. The Soil and Water Districts are covered by Oregon Tort Claims Act, and the department provides their liability insurance, so they are not personally liable as long as they are acting in good faith according to the law. I would point out that also three of our districts have tax bases. Several other districts are very well financed and have the capacity to do easements and do them well. One of the things that our belief is that any easement has to provide for its long-term maintenance and financing, and that would be part of our guidance. And we would, in the annual and long-range plans of work that districts submit to us for review and approval, we would discourage ones that cannot adequately take care of conservation easements from doing them. It's just not wise for them to do that. So I think, you know, the other question is what happens if a district is abolished. I think that the easement itself can provide for that. Mm-hmm. the statutes provide for what can happen if districts are abolished or consolidated, and those are all issues that we would take care of under our oversight authority to make sure that those things are built into the easements that are developed by the districts. And so I guess the concluding comment that I would make is that the soil and water districts are indeed service organizations. They're highly regarded by the farm and ranch constituencies. And we do view this as a service that they would provide. We are not promoting conservation easements that people don't want. It would be the case that landowners would come to the district and ask for one, and the district would provide the service for them. So I don't see an incompatibility there. I think Representative Worth asked a question at the beginning of all of this.
Highway scenic preservation.
That we have evaded thus far. So,
but not any longer.
Jim has the definition of that, and perhaps we can get to that. So.
Representative Worth, for the record, Jim Johnson, I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Department of Agriculture. I think the best way to address the highway scenic easement section is if you look in Section 2 of the bill, it has the existing statute under Sub 3 that talks about what a highway scenic easement is, and it really is a very focused type of easement that really relates to parallel segments of land adjacent to major highways. And I think the key language in there is it talks about possess a significant scenic value in and of themselves. And so some findings that need to be made there related to a significant scenic value. And my experience with these have been they've really been related to corridors along state highways and in some cases federal Forest Service roads where there's actually been a designation of a byway, for example. Highway 101 has a national designation as a national scenic byway, and in a case like that, you may be able to make the findings such that you would acquire an easement in certain segments on a very narrow strip adjacent to the highway. That really doesn't play into the purposes of a soil and water conservation district. They really don't get into to that type of area in their charge or in their purpose of what they do. So I wouldn't see a soil and water conservation district, even though they would have the capability to do that with this language, really getting into that arena. It just doesn't play into what their reason for existence is.
Unless it happens to be a farm.
So what you're telling me is you're educating me. So currently the authorities that are allowed to purchase conservation easements, that also includes the highway scenic. So this is just, okay, this is not something special that you're asking for.
Okay,
thank you.
How do you, any three of you, how do you address the concern that Glenn brought up that any SWCD or actually anybody who offers or has the ability to work with conservation easements could accept them from environmental organizations and have that land taken out of value or out of production? Now, we've just heard you testify that is not your intent, and it's clearly in your testimony. On the other hand, it seems to be happening in other ways, not necessarily in conservation easements. We have private organizations. This happened to me just down the road from my farm, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Took 300 acres of valuable farmland, sold by a private party to a land conservation group. They turned around and sold it to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It now is a continued haven for more geese, which add to the depredation on our fields next to us. How do you answer that concern? Do you feel you have the flexibility that you seem to have stated, John, in your testimony here, or Chuck? Do you think you have the flexibility to make certain that these types of agricultural easements won't be granted for that purpose?
Mr. Chair, I believe we have that, and we're committed to not creating a situation that's objectionable to the sensitivity of our constituents. And keep in mind a couple of things. One, Sloan and Water District directors are elected officials. They're elected in general elections by their constituents. They cannot be oblivious to the concerns of the rural landowners in their district about what is happening to productive agricultural land. Secondly, there are already a large number of special districts, city, county, and state government agencies that can hold easements, and this bill doesn't deal with them. They can do the things you're talking about if they decide to. So I tend to think that, you know, we're kind of the safest bet that there is on this. There's a whole universe out there that really doesn't have the same concerns that we do for the person that makes their living from the land and what happens when you start allowing land to be taken out of production.
John, some further comments?
Yes. Chaircraft, I think there's a couple other things that can be added too, and that is, you know, we bought into this business because we had that concern. I mean, I'm not going to run for election because I want to go out and do something, you know, for roadsides and concrete mixers. We are willing, and what we're saying is we're willing to police ourselves in this sense. We're willing to put our own limitations on ourselves. We talked about, you know, forming rules and guidance and templates and stuff like that. We're willing to say this is the arena in which we work. We're not going to go off into the entire broad range of all the possibilities and the machinations of multiple transfers and stuff like that. That's not what we're after. We do have the backup of the Department of Agriculture reviewing every one of these plans, and Deputy Chuck Craig was quite polite. What's in there is a veto. The law literally says they have a veto power to come up and say if a district is getting into something, even before it's made anything official, it can stop it. And we respect that right, and we use it and depend upon it as a backup. Because, you know, there's always a possibility somebody can do something uninformed and misguided or maybe not paying attention to things, and we've got this backup. We also have the backup of the Natural Resources Conservation Service when we're using any kind of farm bill money, whether it's the Farmland Protection Program or if there's a conservation program or if there's some kind of farm bill thing working on that thing as a, you know, wetland restoration or whatever it may be, all those kinds of easements and so forth, you know, they're going to be closely monitored as to what they're doing and what they can't do. So I think, you know, I think we recognize that. And I'm fully aware of Mr. Stonebrink's concerns. I appreciate him then bringing forth. I appreciate the discussion we've had on the phone addressing these things and other members of the Cattlemen's Association. We recognize those same concerns. All I'm saying is that I think we're intelligent enough and have enough experience and the mechanisms already set up to be able to deal with them adequately.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your testimony, you made it clear that landowners, the only way this gets placed in is if they do it voluntarily. And you talked about the fact that it is legally binding on future landowners who may acquire that land. Is there any way that a landowner could acquire a piece of land that already has an easement on it without the disclosure of the fact that easement would be attached to that parcel?
It would have to come out in the deed search because it's recorded.
It's recorded on the deed.
It's recorded on the deed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Chair. Yeah. Representative Hunt, a conservation easement, a land, agricultural conservation easement, is no different than a utility easement or a mineral right or whatever. It would show up in the title report. Okay. Just want to get that on the record. Thank you. And if I might,
yes, please.
My memory from the first hearing we had on this was that you. One of you had said that the Attorney General's office had said that this was required, and I assume that's still the case, that some action like this is needed in order to fill what was a hole in the original statute.
Representative Hunt, that's correct. The districts have always had the authority to own real property and to hold easements in general, but conservation easements are a special kind of easement that satisfies the Internal Revenue Service codes in particular. And when the statutes that enabled agencies to hold easements were written, they were left out of the group of entities that can hold those. So one of the interpretations that the Attorney General said is possible is that since they were left out of this statute, but they have the authority to hold other kinds of easements, one could conclude that it was legislative intent that they not hold them. So rather than have them do a lot of work and then be challenged somewhere down the road, it's a lot better idea, I think, just to give them the clear authority to hold them.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. Mr. McDonald, in your testimony, you have under number 10, a landowner, B, can still restrict public access. You have that in there for a reason. What would be the process if someone did allow public access?
Chair Krupp and Representative Smith, I'm not quite sure. What would be the process if they did allow it?
What if someone entered a conservation easement with you and allowed public access? What would be the process for the neighbors surrounding?
I think if they chose to do that, it would be like the privilege you have on your own property right now, that you have the right to give that. You could write that into the easement if you wanted to, that it had certain educational benefits, that you could take certain tours, that you want to use it as a demonstration site. It could be a part of the easement. It could be just a part of the fact that you still own the land, you still control the land other than what this easement restriction is. So if you wanted to say, no, you can't come on, or yes, you can,
right,
that's still your personal right.
Then to follow up, you have public hearing at the bottom of that page. What would the public hearing process be for?
The public hearing is to, again, get public comment on what the easement intends to do and its being there, and just to get reaction from the local people so that it's something that people are aware of is going to be set up, that the land is, it's been asked to have this done to this land. And it's like a lot of other processes around you, you know, you want to see what people think about it. And if we require that we would hold a public hearing to samples, you're not running off and doing something sneaky or perceived to be sneaky.
Well, thank you. I guess I'm wondering why we're having a public hearing if you can't if you can't have any effect on the public access portion of it. Are you saying then in the public hearing that it doesn't matter as far as what's done on the conservation easement because it's a private property issue?
Representative Krupp and Representative Smith, I'd like to have Jim focus on that because he deals more with those public hearings
Thank
and so
you.
Forth than I do.
Sure. Representative Krupp, Representative Smith, the access, I think the point that John McDonald had in his ear on access is that nothing when an easement is applied on the land, nothing changes in terms of the ability of a landowner to either limit or to allow access to the property. The easement in and of itself doesn't necessarily make it a campground or a public meeting place or anything like that. That would still have to comply with any provisions that are in land use laws, for example, or mass gathering laws, or just the ability of the landowner to say yes or no. And bottom line, the easement in and of itself doesn't change that unless it's written specifically into the easement and is part of the contract. So if the easement is a farmland protection easement that's basically protecting the land for future agricultural use and precluding non-farm uses, that wouldn't change the ability to allow the public to come on and to hunt or to not allow the public to come on to hunt or whatever. It's basically, in a sense, is leaving that up to the landowner. It doesn't change that. And I think that's really the point here. If you wanted to do some type of land use that actually would allow the public to come on there that actually requires a land use permit, you're still going to have to get that land use permit. The easement doesn't change the land use law.
One more question?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. In your, Mr. McDonald, under positive benefits to a soil and water conservation district, you mentioned the district could charge for this service. Any idea what they would charge?
Chair Krupp and Representative Smith, I have absolutely no idea.
No idea.
We haven't even got to the point of thinking about what would be a fee for service. It would be up to the district to set whatever fee they would wish to choose, or to opt to choose have a fee or not a fee.
Okay, thank you.
This is not an automatic thing. It's another option.
Thank you.
Okay, additional questions, members? Hearing none, thank you. Leo? John, go ahead.
Chair Krupp, I was just going to say, out of courtesy to Legal Press, and I was hoping that you would have time to ask him to come forward.
Absolutely. Okay. He's made the trip here. We're going to have him share his thoughts with us. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, committee.
Welcome, Leo. For the record, state your name, please.
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leo Pressing. I serve as the basin team leader for the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. My office is in McMinnville, and I serve the six counties in the lower Willamette Basin, which include Washington, Multnomah, Yamhill, Clackamas, Polk, and Marion. As you know, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which I refer to as NRCS, is a long-time relationship with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. We partner closely with districts and seek the district's input on many matters through a locally led process. Some of those key matters are natural resource priorities within that district, what practices, measures, or approaches are best suited for that district, as well as we request them to review and approve conservation plans. NRCS provides technical assistance to farmers, ranchers, and landowners through this very close working relationship with the conservation districts. Districts play a very significant role in this process of working with the farmers and ranchers and helping them to accomplish their conservation objectives. Together with the districts, we try to provide a variety of tools available to the landowners that they can choose to meet their needs and their desires and reach their conservation objectives. A conservation easement is one of those tools we have used in the past and hope to continue to use in the future. It is a tool that landowners are beginning to inquire more about than in the past, and is one that people are choosing to utilize more often. A significant source of funding available for landowners to work on conservation measures is the 2002 Farm Bill. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts have a very important and specific role within that Farm Bill, and that they provide us with the locally led input that we need to carry out the conservation programs. One of those programs, as was brought out by Mr. McDonald, is the Farm and Ranch Protection Program. We applied for $1.5 million this year in Oregon, and we just found out yesterday that we got a little over $1 million. That's just for this year. There's potential for more of those funds in the future as we see a response and a need for that program in the state. The program utilizes conservation easements. The conservation easement can be held by a variety of different entities. Agricultural or land trusts are likely land holders of the conservation easements under this program. NRCS believes that soil and water conservation districts are in a very desirable position to hold these conservation easements. And the reason why, from my personal observation and observation within our agency in working with the soil and water conservation districts, a significant concern of landowners is who holds that easement. And that varies from landowner to landowner, what's important to them. There must be a comfort level before the landowner chooses to use this tool. They may think it's a good tool to use, but they will not use it unless there's a comfort level with who's going to hold that easement. In the counties I serve, we have landowners coming in to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, not part of a program, but asking them if they will hold a conservation easement on their land to preserve that land in agricultural land use. No payment, no financial incentive. Actually, they're putting money in as part of a future trust fund to maintain that conservation easement. So we believe when the program, this program is implemented, the farm and ranch lands protection program, there's going to be a strong interest in landowners wanting to enter into easements with the conservation districts, because that's where they see a locally elected official, people they know. They've seen the fruits of their labors in the past, the good things they've done in their conservation efforts, and there's a trust level there. I guess with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be before you today, and if I can answer any questions, I will.
Thank you. Leo, Glenn Stonebrink brought up a number of concerns, and we've sort of talked about them. From your perspective, you're obviously agreeing that this is a good direction to go. Do you think there are adequate flexibility and safeguards in the system as it's developed through ODA's veto power, for lack of a better term, to address those concerns?
Yeah, I think there were several concerns brought up. I think one of the key ones is that a conservation easement is perceived as taking land out of production, when in actuality it can just as easily preserve that land for production for whatever length of the easement is set up for. So from that standpoint, I can't see a great concern. And as I mentioned, NRCS has worked with districts here in Oregon over 50 years. We've been partners. We know their conservation ethic. We have confidence and faith that they will make wise judgments as they choose which conservation easements they will or not work with.
Okay. Questions, members? All right. Thank you, Leo. Appreciate it. Well, members, we're at the moment where I think we've vetted this issue a fair amount. The chair will entertain a motion to move the bill. We are in work session. That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to move that we move House Bill 2754 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Members, Representative Hunt has moved House Bill 2754 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, is there any fiscal?
Ray, do we have a fiscal on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, there is a minimal fiscal impact. It's not required to go to Ways and Means.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative.
Did we have any conversation from the local counties as to loss of tax revenue?
No, I don't recall that we had any testimony to that effect. Ray, do you?
I didn't hear the question.
Representative Smith asked if we had any testimony or any comments from local counties about loss, potential loss of revenue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we did not.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gilman?
Mr. Chair, I'll give a courtesy vote to get this to the floor. I will be a no on the floor.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Byer.
Well, Mr. Chair, this doesn't require anybody to do anything. It just allows this segment to be able to do it if someone should ask them to. So I'm a yes.
Representative Wirth.
I might as well chime in. Last session, I worked with Representative Schrader in getting the conservation easements bill through his bill, and we had concerns that the counties lose tax receipts from that. And because of that, ODF&W put a limit or a cap on the number of conservation easements that can be done. So, and as far as I remember, this would fall under that same cap. So,
okay.
It would be restricted under the same.
Okay. Well, members, I have to tell you that conservation easements make me nervous, personally, as a farmer and as a landowner. But I guess I sort of see this as a lesser of two evils approach to some extent. They can be a valuable tool, I think, for the very used correctly. I think that's clear. I think the point there in the operative term is used correctly, and I'm confident in the soil and water conservation districts and the ODA to manage these agricultural conservation easements. I think there are other easements that are out there that would cause me great distress.
and other organizations that would cause me great distress as a farmer in terms of what could eventually happen to the land. So I'm going to vote for this this bill because I think if there's any one group that ought to be out there that we could trust, it's ODA and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts to do this properly in the best interests of the traditional uses of agricultural land. And so with that, would the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Is excused.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Representative Dillman?
Aye.
Chair Farmer?
Aye. House Bill 2754 is hereby passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And who on the committee would like to carry the bill?
Me.
The chair's prerogative, probably not. Representative Wirth, since you worked with Representative Schrader last session on this, why don't we have Representative Wirth carry the bill. And with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2754, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3270. Ray, we have some amendments here.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have dash ones, twos, threes, and we're looking at the dash three amendments, Mr. Chair, to House Bill 3270. This committee met on the 17th this month to discuss this bill. And in that discussion, we received a lot of testimony, which indicated that there did need to be some adjustments via an amendment avenue. We have those amendments in front of us. What they do is they restate legislative assembly findings, and they define comprehensive slaughterhouses and other slaughterhouses and give some directions to state agencies on how to prioritize appropriating funds to these organizations and require a report back to the Legislative Assembly, the 74th Legislative Assembly, no later than May 1, 2007. But the Commission and the State Department of Agriculture to present a report no later than May 1, 2005. So we've got two reports coming through on this amendment and those other things I had mentioned, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. Let's see. We have some folks who work together on this issue. I'd like to have y'all come forward, OECDD, Dalton, Glenn, anyone else who was in that little work group, and tell us basically what it is we settled on.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I may, this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, as does the other bill scheduled for today, House Bill 3552.
Okay, thank you very much, Ray. Welcome. What have we done? Ron, why don't you go ahead?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, I've not seen the amendments as drafted after our meeting on discussion, so I'm a little unclear as to...
Would you please? Yeah. Please.
Thank you very much. If you don't mind, Chair Krupp, if we have a couple minutes to read
sure.
the amendments.
Sure. That's
Chair Krupp,
yes,
I would be happy to go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead, Glenn? That's fine.
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Basically, this amendment, the dash 3 amendment, of course, you'll see is a far cry from what we started with, and we understand that. Under perhaps normal economic times, we might have thought that this could get some reasonable consideration. We're not in normal economic times, so even though the sale of cattle and calves is the largest commodity, food commodity in the state, and we tend to send most of the added value and the jobs that are related to that commodity out of state, simply because we do not have the facilities. And So, you know, we would like to have that. This, I guess, is what you might kind of call an urge bill. We urge consideration for economic and development funds. Of course, you know, when you urge something, they'll at least look at it, and then they put it on the list, and it has to compete with other needs. So that's what we call it. We would ask for your favorable vote on this, and we know it isn't doesn't guarantee anything by any means. One of the things I might add to that is that you'll see in the bill, and it talks about comprehensive slaughterhouse on the bottom of page 1, line 19. And it means a slaughterhouse that has rendering facilities. And I was asked out in the hall about, you know, what's the big deal? One of the things that happens when you process an animal is that you usually are there for the meat. But there's a lot of other things besides the meat that are a part of an animal. And that has to be taken care of. If you have, if you don't have rendering facilities, a place to take care of that, then that becomes a detriment. And so you have to find a place to send that. So you have transportation costs and oftentimes an actual fee accompanying that to take it to someplace. And then they render it, and actually there is value. There's a considerable amount of value. But if you don't have the facilities there, you don't get to add that to, again, jobs to that community and economic value to that community. So if these processing slaughterhouses are encouraged and there is some economic advantage to doing that in that facility, you're going to be putting economic value back at that facility with jobs at that facility and economics to the community. Have I stalled long enough, Mr. Chairman?
you've done a great job, Glenn, and I appreciate that. Ron?
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, my name is Ron Fox. I'm manager of the business and industry team with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And I think, as mentioned in the committee administrator's comments, the department, in conjunction with other agencies, have been working with industry representatives over the last couple of weeks to try to come up with some amendments that effectively focus the resources of our collective departments, as well as link ourselves to the industry representatives. And in the short time we had to look through the amendments, I think we've captured all of the things that we envisioned as necessary. I might mention just to the committee that in the meeting we had with a group of industry representatives, producers, processors from across the state, there were really a number of issues that were identified that I think our existing department programs, and I speak on behalf of the Economic Development Department, I'll let Dalton speak for the Department of Agriculture, those issues were needs for training workers. That's part of what we do with in support of a number of industry sectors. So I think that's something that we believe we can follow up with with industry representatives. The need to upgrade existing facilities, as the bill mentions, again, within our business loan programs and our other grant programs, working with individual producers and processors, we believe we have the capacity to assist those. And then the last thing is the rendering process that Mr. Stonebrink mentioned, and that was brought up repeatedly in that work group, both from sheep processors as well as cattle processors, as a necessary step. So I think that's an opportunity for our agencies to work with the industry and find a chain of possession that properly handles that part of it. So I think as is written, and I think as it is written, the fiscal impacts that were identified in at least House Bill 3269, which I believe is, this bill has been sort of merged together to become 3270. I don't see there's a fiscal impact with the duties that are assigned to us here. So happy to answer any questions.
Dalton, your thoughts?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I believe that this amendment does properly reflect the work group that we pulled together, and as Glenn Stonebrink mentioned, I think is appropriate for the fiscal and certainly economic times that we find ourselves in. In an earlier hearing, I believe it was Representative Hunt, was asking whether or not other states had similar kinds of programs. We were able to poll our neighboring states, at least to the south and north. Idaho did not respond. And we're able to determine that neither state, Oregon, California, or Washington State, had specific targeted activities similar to these that would have set aside or focused investment incentives for the slaughtering industry. As my counterpart in Washington State, it says they're on their own. So the grass is no greener, at least to the north or south of us. So we're pretty much in league with our neighbors. So there was one other amendment here, or not amendment, but correction. I think that we talked about it as the Economic and Community Development Department and not the commission itself. There are two different entities. And so that would be Ron Fox's department, not the Oregon Economic Development Commission. And if I think with that correction, I believe that this amendment does capture what needs to be done.
Are you, Ron, do you concur with that we should make that correction in terms of verbiage?
Yes. Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, yes. I think in the quick look we had on page one of the dash three amendments, line 22, it makes reference to the Economic Community Development Commission. That's actually the appointed body by the governor that directs our department. I think the correct verbiage would be department, so that would direct the department to perform this work. We operate under the guidance and direction from the commission. And I think that is repeated at least two or three other times through the document. So it's a simple, I mean, I don't want to say that it's simple. It's just a word change that will properly describe the department that you're asking to focus.
Page 2, line 17.
Yeah, page 2, line 6, and then I think line 17 is John Brink mentions. And then again on page 3, line 2.
And those, two and 5.
2 and 5. Yes, you're correct. Thank you.
Okay, well, Legislative Council has delivered us a request that we not conceptually amend at this point. So what I'm going to ask us to do, members, if you are willing, is let us make this change from commission to department over on the Senate side as we're running into timelines here and the Senate's nervous about keeping House bills up for consideration, it seems. So one other question I wanted to ask, in our evolution of the and I guess I'll ask this question not only you but also the committee, in our evolution of this bill in amendments, in our dash ones, we had a requirement. It was a suggestion to me by a member of the cattlemen's in regards to the meat processor who takes advantage of these loans of donating some meat to the Oregon Food Bank. And that is deleted in the dash three amendments. It's not in there. What do you all think about that?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, I think at that time it was like we were thinking it, if these facilities had some type of guarantee, in a sense, this money was going to be made available by either of those bills, then in a sense you should give something back.
Right.
I can't speak for them to say that they're, you know, that is still a binding contract. I think it would have been had there been some guarantees that money's going to be available. But I think, you know, we're still going to keep working in that vein with some of the, well, kind of gruesome to talk about, but sometimes when cattle meet the end of their productive life, and I'll be honest, and sometimes they get in a fairly low state physical condition, but yet there is a value. There is a food value that we're going to work on some voluntary programs, maybe not this session we can get anything through, but for some tax credits for those who would voluntarily give those animals, they could be processed, and that could also be a gift from the processor, and then it could end up in the food bank. We're going to work on
that. We're actually doing the processing.
It's a good relationship.
And that was part of, if members, if you had your dash one amendments, that was actually part of on page 2, that concept was that in addition to the requirement that they donate the meat, there was also a tax incentive for someone, a producer, who donated in that very circumstance right there.
Okay.
And I'm, you know, members and you on the panel, I'm not married to making that part of this thing. If we wanted to further refine that on the Senate side, we could do that too. It's okay with me. I think there ought to be some incentive, though, to producers who have an animal that is still worth value and offering that to society for the food bank. I'd like to see us at least work on that in some fashion in the future.
Chairman Krupp,
yes.
If I might add, this coming Monday, all of Oregon's 28 commodity commissions, along with the Oregon Food Bank, will be meeting with the governor to discuss ways that the Oregon Commodity Commissions can get more involved in this exact same kind of thing. This bill notwithstanding, I believe that you'll see a lot more participation from the producer groups themselves, and already a couple of very, very good ideas have come forward, and we hope to have this as a permanent structural part of Oregon's contribution to hunger here in the state. So we're working in some other avenues in that regard.
Okay. Representative Beyer.
If you can help me, what would your definition of priority consideration be? And have we ever done that with any other product in the state before? The legislature, have we ever said, please identify this? And
Chairman Krupp, Representative Beyer, I'm not familiar with that term being used. I think it was a term we jointly developed in sort of crafting this amendment that would give focus to this sector of the agricultural industry. And I think as in the amendments, it says any grants or any loans are in compliance with the rules and administrative rules and standards for those programs. So it was intended to create a focus by the agencies, but I'm not aware of a similar component in another.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, I've dealt with that term, although it's not defined here, when I was working with U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the first thing that came to mind is when we start talking about programs that would be for the Native Americans or other minority groups. What that says was you give priority consideration. So don't just ignore those people. You put them up there first, and then so you make sure you're given equal weight with others, but you put them at the top for consideration, and that's what we did. We followed the letter of the law and considered all of the things, marked down all the pluses and minuses, and then we considered other things. And if they came up even, we'd give consideration to them first. But only if things came up even with all the pluses and minuses.
Keep in mind, this is for a four-year time period, too, in terms of it's not something that runs in perpetuity. And if I remember correctly, not every program that OECDD has available, this would be appropriate for, correct?
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, I guess just doing a mental checklist, we have a number of business loan programs. Some of those would apply, some might not. But clearly our assistance and support to industry sector workforce development would this sector of the industry would qualify, would be appropriate definition, and that so there's maybe some that don't specifically apply. I can't think of one directly, but I think a number of our programs, so there is a good number of tools that we have in our toolbox that are appropriate and can be applied to this particular sector of the economy.
Now, previously in the original iteration of this bill, we had dollar limits established. Now, in the Dash 3s here, there are no dollar limits established. How would you envision that working? If there was potentially priority consideration given to an applicant in one of the appropriate programs, should we establish a dollar limitation on how much should be granted in a particular loan fund for this purpose?
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, I would think that the loans are made to individual businesses. So some of our programs have loan limits that are defined within those programs, so that would take precedence. But I think and I'm thinking back to the discussions we had with the individual industry representatives during our work groups, and each of them talked about what they thought would be the amount of money necessary for their individual business to modernize and become more productive and more efficient, and those varied from smaller amounts to larger amounts, but I think they were generally within the range of the programs that the department has available. So I think the limitations that are assigned to our specific business loan programs, and I apologize, I don't know the details at my fingertips, but I think those will fit the definitions as were described to us in this one meeting we had with industry representatives.
Okay, so to reiterate what you said, you have certain limits in your various loan programs that would self-limit these circumstances anyway. Is that right?
Chairman Krupp, that's correct.
Okay.
We have maximum amounts for loan programs, and we have individual business loan limits. So those two would create we're limited to the amount of loans we can issue in a biennium and have a revolving loan amount, and also individual loans are limited by definition.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Hunt?
Mr. Chair, related to the same issue related to priority consideration. I understand, obviously, all your loan programs are not going to empty out and go to slaughterhouses, but, if there are other areas, other industries within Oregon agriculture that may have very legitimate issues connected with the need for more technology, the need for better equipment, the need for expanding their processes and updating their processes, it sounds like this is, am I understanding correct, this is creating basically a new category? So if it's a fruit or vegetable processor or some other agricultural producer, that they would be basically put at a, I don't know what, no other terminology used besides somewhat of a disadvantage, all else being equal, that by this priority consideration status here, it would elevate this one particular slice of industry to a newly created level.
Chairman Krupp, Representative Hunt, I wouldn't think that that giving priority consideration would in that sense give a disadvantage to another sector of industry of Oregon's economy, other than to the extent that the department does have some maximum limits to the loan programs and to any grant funds that we might be allocated in the next biennium. I think the wording that was chosen here was chosen to reflect the indicated value and importance to the beef processing and livestock processing industry, and limited this to a four-year period in which part of the bill's responsibility is for the Agriculture Department and our department to work with the industry to find to determine the special conditions and special needs that might then internally be reflected in other program options that are programmed in support of that industry. So I'm speaking, I guess, from the intent of the way the amendment was drafted, was to give a focused attention to this sector without precluding the ability for any other sector of the Oregon economy to have access to those programs. There's no monetary, no amount of money set aside either in loans or in grants specifically for this sector. So it's a fair competition, I would say.
Yes, Representative.
If I could follow up, I guess for my feeble mind, the original bill, not less than 5%. I understood that was clear, kind of not debatable. I guess I just need some further help in understanding how this doesn't. If there's not a list of the priority and the not priority industries, how does saying priority consideration shall be given to one specific piece of one sector not elevate that in a way that when you all are looking at things, again, all else being equal, I'm not arguing you're going to empty all your coffers and give them to slaughterhouse. It just seems like all else being equal, right now you have the ability to step up and say, here's a specific need. We should do this, weighing all factors equal. It seems like this adds a new factor into the equation that would be unique. Am I misreading that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, if I might respond from the Department of Agriculture perspective, each year we plan our program of work and actually internally develop a list of work priorities, not legislative priorities, but sectors that we're going to work on. This year, for the last 5 years, have actually been working on the beef industry, and I think a lot of that work has paid off in terms of extra or new markets, export markets for beef products from the state. In addition to the beef industry, we've worked on the seafood industry, and you heard about the slime eel earlier. Seasonal vegetable processing is another priority that we have, as we've seen the decline here in the Willamette Valley in seasonal vegetable processing, as well as the grass seed. So those sectors have been quote-unquote priorities. These are things that are sectoral, that are focused in terms of our program of work. In addition to those structural elements of our program, we also have the complete set of activities we do for individual companies that may or may not be in part of that, one of those focused things. But we do have targeted, focused activities in each one of those sectors that are designed to enhance and develop that particular sector. Adding priority for us is really part of our daily work from the standpoint of we've identified it already. This fits in very, very nicely, and I really look forward to working with economic development on this and reporting back in a couple of years about how this has enhanced the beef industry here in the state.
Additional questions? Members?
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3270 on the -3 amendments? Hearing none, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3270. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3552. Gray? You want to tell us what we've got going on with 3552?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On House Bill 3552, you should have -2 amendments in front of you. The -2s go over some legislative findings relative to forest landowners. And the -2s repeal the bill. It sunsets January 31st, 2005. In between that, there's some incentives created to encourage forest practices that implement current statute, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Come forward, Christina. And anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3552 and the -2 amendments and what we're trying to achieve here?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I will try to be brief. Do you have a copy of the -2 amendments that we could look at? For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And with me are two folks who've worked incredibly hard out of the Department of Forestry to try to come to some agreement on how this bill should move forward. When we last talked to you, I had Sarah Lyman and Gary Springer, small woodland owners, talking about the effect of some regulatory practices on their land. And the long and the short of it is the -2 amendments replace basically the bill as it's written now and has a statement of purpose that the legislature recognizes that private forest landowners provide a range of public resource benefits and then talks about a public recognizing there's a limit to what should be reasonably expected of landowners in providing public benefits. And to provide appropriate recognition for the contribution that forest landowners make when providing public benefits above such a limit. What that limit is yet to be determined. The -2 amendments give the Department of Forestry, the Board of Forestry more specifically, the task to set up a committee under their authority to evaluate the range of regulatory burdens that occur on forest land. and then I think it would be our expectation that we would report to the next Legislative Assembly on those findings and hopefully have some legislation that all parties are in agreement to. The one comment I would make is that House Bill 3552, the relating clauses relating to forest practices, which is a state regulation, and these amendments are, they say on page idea is that it refers to federal regulations too, and we're really only interested in state regulations, so we might draw a line out of the federal
page
language.
Line 21
on page 2. So we would prefer it to read an advisory committee to evaluate the range of state regulatory burdens.
Page 2, line 21?
Page 1, line 21. Sorry. I don't know if that's an issue with the committee to strike the word and the word federal on line 21, and if it is, that's something we could certainly do on the Senate side. Thank you.
Okay. Members, discussion? Yes, Representative Gilman.
Christina, you, I think on the original bill there was something about 10% or something like that, and you've decided that you'll leave that up to this commission then.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, that's true. The original bill had some of these concepts tightened down a little bit more. There was a regulatory threshold of 10%, at which point that would provide a private forest landowner to go to the Department of Forestry to find some sort of regulatory remedy in developing an alternative plan that would still meet the same purposes of the Forest Practices Act, not to weaken it, but to come up with an alternative plan over a broader landscape, perhaps. And then the second thing that the original bill did was set up a fund in order to receive maybe federal funds or other dollars or donations for conservation incentives programs or a variety of different things. Both of those concepts, I think, would still be considered by the Board of Forestry, by the committee that would be set up under this process, but we have not specified an outcome in this process.
Representative Smith? Anything? Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Christine, because I too read the wording to include and federal regulatory burdens is almost impossible if we were actually trying to look for options for equalizing the effects of regulation when a single ownership is affected through undue regulatory burden. If we were looking to the state to equalize the burden that is put on by the federal regulations, I think we'd go bankrupt in 5 minutes. So I would very much support your revision.
Members, keep in mind that this has a sub-referral to Ways and Means. So is that correct, Ray?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The original bill has sub-referral, and reading the dash two amendments, the sub-referral should remain on because it is telling the Board of Forestry to establish an advisory committee, so we need to take a look at the fiscal impact of that.
Christina.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, we'll leave that up to your discretion, but I think it was our understanding that there was not a fiscal associated with that to the department, that they were going to undertake that duty in their regular course of action in front of the board, and that, in fact, because there were no other funds or any sort of fund established under the Dash 2 amendments, that perhaps it didn't need to go to Ways and Means, but that's up to your discretion.
Clearly, you can make the amendment in Ways and Means. Having the State Board of Forestry to establish an advisory committee that would evaluate the range of state and federal regulatory, that word and federal, in the staff's opinion, and I tend to agree, would be a monumental expense to the Department of Forestry. So if that can be amended, I think it probably makes sense to take away. I guess the question is, in terms of policy and what we're trying to establish, is it all right to go to Ways and Means and take care of that issue there? Is that less desirable, we can have the bill amended and bring it back for Thursday. Please.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
What do you guys want to do?
I'd recommend that we move forward and we could maybe address this in ways and means.
Okay. Christina doesn't agree.
Mr. Chair and members, I think this bill is going to be just fine. I'm just very aware of the backlog in ways and means. And if there's a way we can avoid that, I would support that. But it really is up to you. I think that we'll do fine whatever we do, and we appreciate your support.
I Ways and Means has a backlog, but fortunately, they can stay open for a long time, and the policy committees on the Senate side are not going to. So I'm frankly trying to move many of my own bills to Ways and Means because they'll survive, and they may not if we have to run them back through policy side, just because the time that we're into in terms of shutting these committees down, both on the House and Senate.
So, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So by saying that, am I to read into that that you're uncomfortable striking the word "and federal" as a conceptual amendment, and that's why it would go to Ways and Means?
Well, legislative council is really doesn't want us to do that. We could, but I think I'm losing members unless I can get people back quickly here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, for your information, in my other committee this morning, the question was asked regarding conceptual amendments, and the committee was told directly no.
I guess that's a good answer. Why don't we just move it to Ways and deal with it there?
Sure.
I think it's probably a better direction.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith.
I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3552.
Very good. Ray, would you run out and see if you can find Representative Beyer and Hunt so they can vote on this? Members, Representative Smith has graciously moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 3552. Discussion? Representative Wirth.
Sure, I'm going to. Oh, no, never mind. Wrong one, never mind.
Yeah, the no isn't
so quick to talk.
Any further discussion, members? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. House Bill 3552 is hereby amended, and now the chair would entertain Representative Smith.
I'll move House Bill 3552 as amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass.
With a due pass. Members, House Bill 3552 is moved to the Ways and Means Committee as amended with a due pass. Discussion? Representative Wirth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna vote no just based upon the concerns that Christina raised, as and I have the same concerns, just as a flag to make sure that this gets done in Ways and Means, but I'll be an emphatic yes on the floor if to make sure it's changed the way we hope. Expect.
Key phrase on emphatic.
Emphatic. I will.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. House Bill 3552 is by prior reference referred as amended with a due.
That was a no.
She's got a no. We gotta have a vote.
We can.
David, call the roll.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. I took your emphatic on the floor.
He's like, go.
Representative Pines.
Aye.
Sure, I'm not emphatic for y'all.
Excuse me.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Ward.
No.
Aye. House Bill 3552 is hereby referred by prior reference as amended with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means. Close a work session on that, and we are adjourned. Thank you, members, for great work today. Appreciate it all. Thank you, members of the